I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. It is the end of the traditional growing season here in the Northeast. Some people have greenhouses to give them a little edge in the shoulder season, but most home gardeners are picking the last of their tomatoes, pulling dead stalks, and enjoying the hearty greens like kale and root veggies that, like carrots, for example, that can handle a little bit of the cold. We asked VPR staffers to brag or confess about the state of their gardens. Classical host Kari Anderson says all of the tomato vines are basically dead but have orange globes hanging off of them, so I haven't yanked them out of the ground yet. The strawberry plants always astonish me that they still look completely full of life so late in the season. Eggplants and peppers are finally ripe and ready to pick. And our major giving officer, Leanne Kleiser-Link, writes, dried corn stalks make an unmistakable sound indicating that the garden season is at an end. Colorful zinnias withstand the first frosts of the season, maintaining color while the cucumber vines start to die back. Scallions, kale, and lettuce still bring me into the garden each day before preparing dinner. All right, listeners, you can share what's happening in your garden with us. Post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. or call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. And as always, we are thrilled to welcome back horticulturist and garden consultant Charlie Nardozzi, who also hosts VPR's Vermont Garden Journal. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Lynn.
So what are you doing these days? What are you putting in your garden? I see it's okay. You
can
call me whatever you want.
I was thinking of someone completely different, and it's not you. It's Jane. What's going on in our garden? Well, it is time to clean up things, and certainly that's been happening. And every time we pull something out, we put something back in, and whether it be a green crop of some type or a green manure or a cover crop. So that's what's been happening. But we also have been continuing to harvest. And here in the Champlain Valley where we live, things have not really gotten to the frost level quite yet. So the tomatoes, the peppers, the eggplants, like a lot of the VPR staff we're talking about, are still coming in and still pouring in, actually. And my trombocino is doing very well.
What's a trombocino?
I'm glad you asked that. It's an heirloom Italian vining squash. And it grows up vines, up trellises, up fences, and it grows like a zucchini. And so it's a long, thin squash, and at the bottom is kind of a bulb shape to it. You can pick it when it's maybe about a foot long or so, and it's great as a summer squash because as you slice it, there are no seeds until you get to the bulb, and then you might have a few seeds. So it's very consistent that way. And you can also eat it as a winter squash, and I have one that's about 5 feet tall right now, hanging from my fence. And slowly it's turning into a winter squash, getting that hard skin on it. I haven't a clue what it's going to taste like.
But the squash itself is about 5 feet?
5 feet tall. I should bring it in.
You could feed an army with that.
I'm not sure what I'm going to do with it, but it's a novelty at the very least. So as you know, I just came back from Sicily doing a garden tour, food and garden tour of Sicily. And so I saw some trombocinos there in the market. So
not 5 foot tall.
Not 5 feet tall. They want to keep them a little smaller. They're a little more delicious that way.
And haven't grown these before?
I know. This is a new crop for me.
Okay, so yeah. You're trying new things still,
as an expert or someone who's been growing for many years. Yeah, that's kind of the fun of it. So I've been trying a lot of new things. Tried some quinoa this year. Unfortunately, didn't get much seed out of it. Beautiful plant, looked really nice, but the seed didn't really form the way I was hoping. So there's always experiments. Some work and some don't.
Yeah, I experimented with husk cherries this year, and those worked well. I also experimented with a sort of a black cover to put over to try to aid in not having to do so much weeding, and that was a total failure. More weeds and less ability to actually pull them because they were coming up under this
under the
thingy.
Yeah,
that was a disaster.
So
anyway, listeners, you can tell us what's been a disaster for you. Maybe you want some advice from Charlie on something that you could do better, or a crop that just is not working for you. You're worried about your soil. You're worried about placement, sunlight. What's going on in your garden right now? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. So what else are people being able to pull from their gardens right now? Knows some greens. Mm-hmm. Leanne mentioned that she's also pulling things like lettuces, and kale is very hardy, can withstand some frost.
Right. There's a number of crops that can withstand frost and a light freeze, like kale, Brussels sprouts. Some of these crops you can leave in there. Even things like Swiss chard I've had survive, especially if you have some big leaves in Swiss chard. A nice little tip to do is, you know how you can cover cauliflower to blanch them? Well, you can do the same thing with Swiss chard. Take those big leaves, wrap them over the top, string them together, and what it does is it protects the a growth point in the center of your Swiss chard. And if you do that on a night where you think you might get down into the low 30s, maybe upper 20s, the upper leaves might get frosted and killed, but that growth point stays alive. Then we get Indian summer, like we often have here in Vermont. So you can unfurl it, take off the frosted leaves, and you have some new growth coming out of the center.
So you're sort of creating like a bun or a ponytail at the top of
the
plant.
Yes, exactly. Just kind of tying it up, and that's enough protection if it only gets a couple degrees below freezing to protect them.
And something like carrots, you can leave those in the ground really late.
We leave them in the ground literally into the winter. So carrots, parsnips, beets, I haven't had as much success with trying to get those to go through the toughest part of the winter. But certainly carrots and parsnips, what we'll do is probably more towards Thanksgiving, maybe a little earlier, depending on how the fall shakes out here, is we'll get about a foot thick layer of hay or straw and just bury it. And just bury it really deeply. And what that does, it protects those carrots and prevents the ground from freezing. So you can go in January, February, knock off the snow, move the hay across, and pull out some carrots.
And what's the difference in flavor?
It's much sweeter. So what's happening right now is that you have a lot of starches in those roots because that's what's been accumulated during the growing season. As they start to age, they start turning those starches into sugars. So it gets much sweeter as we go more towards the spring.
So would you say it's better to just keep them in the ground than to put them in a root cellar?
If you can do a root cellar, it's probably a lot easier. You don't have to go out in the middle of the winter to dig out your carrot bed. But certainly the flavor of it is comparable if you can keep them in the ground. It's like your own little root cellar, but it's out in the garden itself.
All right, let's go to Ruth, who's calling in from Essex Junction. Hi, Ruth. Go ahead.
Thanks a lot. Charlie, Ruth Scriptunis. I was on your trip to Sicily.
Yes, I know, Ruth. How are you?
I am well, thank you. And yourself?
I'm doing very well. I'm getting used to the time change and kind of back in mode.
Thanks for saying that, because I have two questions, specifically regarding the fall. Why are some bulbs propagating? Like, what's the distribution and what's the difference? Because I have in the front of my garden king crocuses that are propagating, and I've had them for years, and I love them. And then other plants or bulbs don't say that when I buy it.
Uh-huh. So when you say propagating, Ruth, what are you referring to?
They replenish themselves, and they spread.
Oh, okay.
More of them.
All right.
So
if I had
10, then I get more.
Right, yeah. So, yeah, there are certain bulbs that will naturalize easily. Crocuses, snowdrops, scillas, grape hyacinths, a lot of the smaller bulbs, species tulips. It's just because they are tough bulbs and they survive the winter pretty easily. And they'll also will form seed, which can spread around like a scilla, for example. You've probably seen lawns of all those blue flowers in the spring. A lot of times that's scilla that's spread all over the place. So it really has to do with the bulb itself. And a lot of those bulbs are the species versions or very close to it. So they're going to be much hardier, much tougher to make it through the winter. As opposed to things like the hybrid tulips or the hyacinths, those bulbs are really not meant to be something that's going to last a long time in the garden. And so they're not going to propagate themselves or naturalize as easily.
What do you mean when you say species bulbs?
So species bulbs mean they're closer to the original form. So, for example, tulips. There are the regular Darwin tulips and the parrot tulips, all the ones you normally see, those are heavily hybridized tulips by the Dutch mostly. And they were actually developed for the pot culture, for those tulips that you see.
You got to be careful when you say that, Charlie.
I wasn't even going to go there. I'm being good. So they were developed for the container culture. How about that? You like that better? So that when you go into a greenhouse in January, February, you'll see those bulbs that are forced. That's really what they are developed for the big show kind of things. They really weren't developed for a home gardener to have them for years upon years. So those hybrid versions of those tulips that are out there are nice, but they're not going to be something that's going to naturalize or propagate. A species version of those, which are there are a number of different tulip species, are closer to the wild relatives from Turkey and that Asia Minor area where they grow naturally. And so they are much more adapted to the climate, and they will slowly spread. They're not the big showy tulips, but they're very beautiful and very delicate. And in fact, we grow more of those than the hybrid ones.
You know, I was just joking, but are you looking at now hemp growing, which is, of course, industrial hemp, big in some places,
right,
starting to take hold a little bit in some places in the U.S. And then do you, as somebody who's interested in gardening, look at states that are legalizing marijuana and think about what kind of crops would grow well here as the legislature considers whether or not to legalize that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, I'm not a marijuana grower, so I can't really speak from experience on it. But, you know, certain states will have more of an advantage, certainly a place like California with a milder climate to grow a really intense crop. And that's why often a lot of these crops are grown under lights or indoors or in greenhouses, because you can get the intensity that you're looking for in the quality plant. Whether it be a marijuana plant or a tomato plant, you really have same kind of factors involved as far as the fertility, the light needs of it, and the intensity of the flavor, or in this case, the chemical that you're trying to develop to enhance it.
Let's go to Ken, who's calling in from Salisbury. Hi, Ken. Go right ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the program. It's always really helpful. I enjoy it. I have access to almost an unlimited supply of dry chicken manure from a neighboring farm, and I have three questions related to that. I know it's really hot, so I shouldn't put it down in the spring, but can I get some now, put it down now in the fall, or do I need to let it season for a year? I've got some that's seasoning in a big barrel that's over a year old. Is that too old? And lastly is how much I tend to sprinkle it on, like it's a commercial fertilizer, and I don't know if that's not enough or too little or whatever.
Yeah, so a lot of it has to do with the age of it as far as how much to put down. But it is good to not put the fresh material down. And I would suggest putting it in as part of a compost system that you might have. So as you're pulling plants out of the garden, you maybe have some hay or straw still left, to mix it in with that and really try to have it break down a little bit better before you apply it to the garden. By putting it down now, what will end up happening is that chicken manure is high in volatile nitrogen that's easily released into the atmosphere. So you're going to lose some of that benefit just by putting it down now and letting it sit all winter. But if you put it into a compost pile, it's going to lock up some of that nitrogen, so you'll have a better benefit next spring when you're putting it down.
And just quickly, Charlie, the differences between using chicken manure and horse manure or mm-hmm. other kinds of that type of organic matter.
That kind of organic matter. So yes, there are different manures that have different characteristics. So the cow manures are the ones that are probably the best overall manure, especially the dairy cow manures, to give a general tilth or fertility to the soil so that they grow a little bit better. Horse manure is okay. It's very plentiful, usually for free. You can get it from a lot of these horse farms, but it can have problems with weed seeds because the horses don't have the four stomachs that the cows do, so they don't break down those seeds as readily. You can get some exotic manures, llama and alpaca manures, which are kind of like sheep manures as far as their dry materials. Fairly good nutritional content to them, and always good to add organic matter. And then, of course, chicken manure, as we were talking about, that's the one that's really high in nitrogen, very volatile kind of compound, really hot manure is what they say. It's nice to add that to a compost pile to really get other things to break down.
We're talking about fall gardening today with gardening expert Charlie Nardozzi. Just ahead, we're going to talk a little bit about how to grow salad greens indoors all winter long. So don't despair with these darker evenings, cold nights. And of course, we're going to take more of your calls and emails. You can write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and today we're talking gardening with Charlie Nardozzi. You can share your questions with us by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts at vpr.net. When you look out the window at your garden, do you despair and think, oh my gosh, there's just so much to do. I'll never get it ready for next year. I don't even know what to do with it. All right, we have some answers for you. We've also probed our own staff for gardening thoughts and are sharing some of those with you today. VPR reporter Amy Noyes tells us that the garden looks brown and sad. Droopy, frost-killed squash plants await pulling despite one too late bright orange blossom under a mushy fan of leaves. The peppers that were bushy just last week are now withered. Sage and parsley patches the size of small hedges are the only plants still standing proud in the crisp autumn air. And our IT director, Todd Mallory, writes, the kitchen is literally overtaken with basil. We painstakingly remove the leaves for half an hour or so, and then we get really sick of the overwhelming smell of basil and move into a very haphazard method. Brown leaves, stems, snails, whatever, it's all getting ground up anyway. Pulling homemade basil pesto out of the freezer in the dead of winter and stirring it into pasta or eating it with a spoon is one of the great delayed joys of the garden. So share your thoughts like that with us. Go to our Facebook page and you can wax poetic on the gardening season. And if the end of the traditional growing season has you feeling a little down, have hope. We're joined now by Peter Burke, who lives in Calais. He is the author of the guide Year-Round Indoor Salad Gardening. It's from Chelsea Green Publishing. Peter, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Well, thanks. You've got it. There's good news. Still
good.
Garden.
All right. Well, make us feel better. I mean, your book offers this promise of growing and eating salad greens winter long.
That's
all
it.
You need is a windowsill and a pot. So
and I try to say, tell people that my greenhouse is a house full of greens all winter long.
Is that what inspired you to do this, a fear of a long, cold winter with no fresh greens?
Well, yes. Yes, I'm not sure it was a fear, but it was definitely a dread. I started almost 10 years ago now, and I just decided I was going to figure out how to grow fresh greens. And it went a completely different direction than I thought it was going to. I ended up growing little trays of greens, planting a little bit every day. And I just found out that it was a tremendously productive way to garden. On average, I'll grow about 12, 14, 16 ounces of greens every day from as little space as 20 inches by 72 inches. So that's a shelf that's, 1 foot 8 by 6 foot high. So it's a very, very productive way to garden indoors.
And give us a couple of the salad greens that are really good or really easy to grow.
Most popular are the sunflower greens and the pea shoots. Those are the most popular. I really enjoy the radish greens. They sort of have a little bit of, they have a perfect radish flavor, just a little bit of burn to them, and they're great. And then I grow buckwheat lettuce, and I grow some form of broccoli, sometimes purple kohlrabi, sometimes Chinese cabbage, just depends.
And then you mix them all together, or do you eat them?
Mix them all together, yep. And you can do a couple different things. You can either mix them all together to make an all-sprout salad, or you can, choose a couple for the specific salad you're making. I make just one out of buckwheat and sunflower. We use the sunflower. Whenever my son is going to be home, I try to grow extra sunflower because he'll cut a whole tray and put it in a sandwich, crunch it down and eat the whole thing. So I try to have extra for him.
Peter, what do these look like? I mean, we're not talking about huge whole sunflowers that you're growing on your windowsill. So these are soil sprouts, right?
That's right. They're like sprouts in that you grow in jars, except that I'm growing them in soil. And there's just a lot of advantages of growing them in soil because it's so much easier to take care of. You water once a day with just a watering can. There's none of that rinsing and stuff. The hulls drop right off as they're growing, and as the seed leaf spreads open, the sunflower hulls drop off. Buckwheat hulls drop off. Of course, the peas don't have any hulls, but it just is so much easier to grow. I always tell people that you can't mess this up. There's just so many things you can do wrong and still get it right.
Well, so give us a little bit more about that. I mean, basically, you're forcing these in darkness first,
yep.
And then bringing them out. But
yep.
it's pretty easy.
Oh yeah. Well, the first instruction is plant them and then do nothing for 4 days. Or if you're going to put them in a dark, I use a cupboard up over our the refrigerator because it's a little bit warmer there. And so they're grown just completely in the dark. You don't have to do anything with them for 4 days. Once they're up about an inch, then they come out and go on the windowsill. And it can be any window, north, south, east, west, doesn't make any difference. If you can see, there's enough light to green these things up. Another 3, 4, 5 days on the windowsill and, you're ready to harvest. But, no matter what green you get in the grocery store, whether it's, and we call them fresh, and I know they're fresh, but they're at least 3 or 4 or 5 days old, and in some cases they're 3 or 4 or 5 weeks old, depending on how far they've come. There is nothing as fresh as taking it off your windowsill, cut it, and put it in a salad. That's the freshest thing you can possibly ever have.
Well, and if you want to know more about how to do it, you can pick up Peter's book. It's called Year-Round Indoor Salad Gardening.
Yep.
Peter Burke lives in Calais, and he does this himself all winter long. Peter, thank you for talking with us.
Well, sure, yeah.
All right, listeners, if you grow greens all winter long, you can tell us about it. What works for you? Does it even work in a drafty old farmhouse with not very good window insulation? Let us know what you're doing. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Charlie, I want to get into more of the calls, but what do you do in the winter to keep yourself feeling like you've still got some green in your life?
Well, we treated ourselves this summer. We put up a greenhouse. It's a freestanding greenhouse with polycarbonate siding on it, so we're not quite sure how far into the winter we're going to be able to go, so it's a big experiment right now. But as of right now, we're eating bush beans and kale and collards and fresh spinach and lettuce and parsley, and it all looks very happy.
Other than that, do you feel like in the wintertime you finally get a chance to put your feet up and relax?
Yeah, a little bit. But, you know, there's always planning to do and everything else that's going along with that. But we try to eat seasonally a lot of times, too. So as we're coming into the fall, into the winter, we find myself eating more carrots, more beets, potatoes, winter squashes, a lot of those types of crops. And then just kind of following the natural rhythm of your body. Usually by February, March, the light levels start coming back. The craving for the greens start coming back. So that's when we hope to start a little more green growing in our greenhouse while it's still snowy outside, but warm enough inside to get things to grow.
We got a note from Andrew who says, I'm going to try planting garlic in our raised beds for the first time this weekend. Any tips?
Ah, the old garlic 101. We can go through the whole thing. So first thing you want to do is make sure you get garlic bulb varieties that are adapted to our region. Don't go to the grocery store and buy those that they're selling there because most of those come from California, which are not hardy here. And then you have a choice of usually two, if not three different types. There's the hardneck, which forms those scapes you've probably seen in farmers markets and other places.
Yeah, it's like a curlicue of green.
The curlicue of green, which is edible, and it's really nice to grow them for that as well as the bulb. There are the soft necks, which are the ones you tend to see that are braided. They have nice leaves that braid together really well.
And, so, then, and those you don't harvest a scape in the middle of the season.
Right,
from.
You don't get any scapes from those. And then there are elephant garlic, which is actually closer to related to a leek than a garlic, a very mild garlic flavor, but it's huge. It's the size of, consider a ball sitting in your hand. That's how big the bulb is. One of the cloves is about the size of a whole bulb of a hardneck variety. So those are the three types that you'll grow. It's good that he has a raised bed. That's the best thing to grow them on because if there's one thing that will kill garlic, it's cold, wet soil. So you want to make sure your bed is raised up, well-drained, clean it off, any kind of plants that might have been there, debris that might be left behind, and then plant those individual cloves, I'd say about 4 to 6 inches apart, 2 to 3 inches deep into the soil, the pointy end up. I always like to say that, just in case. And one thing you could do before you plant is actually break up the bulb and put it in a big pot or a big bowl, and just leave it for overnight so a callus starts forming on the bottom of it. That'll help it start its rooting process a little sooner. Once it's all planted, and you can plant a lot, in even just a 2x2 square area, you can plant 30-40 cloves, which will turn into 30-40 bulbs. And unless you're Italiano like an Ardozzi here, that's a lot of garlic to eat. So then come November or so, that's when I like to put some hay or straw on top of it to mulch it over for the winter, and then you just leave it.
So we got this note from Andrew who says he's doing it next weekend or this weekend.
Yes.
But if people are not quite that far advanced, maybe they haven't even gotten their garden ready. Can you do it, you know, up until the ground is frozen?
Yeah, you start running more of a risk. If we get a real early freeze into the soil in November, for example, especially if you're up in the Northeast Kingdom or a colder spot, you're running the risk of the roots not getting well established into the soil. So any time in October really is ideal. And especially if you're in a warmer spots of the state, in the Connecticut River Valley, Champlain Valley, you could probably go towards the end of October and still be okay.
Let's go to John, who's on the line with us from Burlington. Hey, John, go right ahead.
Hi there. My question relates to Jerusalem artichokes, which, as far as I know, are unrelated to Jerusalem or artichokes.
That's true.
So, John, you want to know what they are?
So, no, I know what they are. I have them in my backyard, and they grow like weeds. And I want to know, when's the best time to pull these rascals? I never know whether I should let them go through until another time of the year, or do I just take them late in the winter, even like carrots?
You could take them right now, actually. This would be a good time of year to dig them up and harvest some of those tubers. And if you do mulch them enough so the ground doesn't freeze, you can just harvest them right into the winter as well. Don't worry about harvesting too many of them because they will always come back.
Whether you want them or not.
Whether you want them or not.
All right. Sally is on the line with us from Barton. Hi, Sally. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about horseradish. Every year I want to take my horseradish root to the family Passover gathering, and we're in the Northeast Kingdom. I go to dig it and the ground is too hard. Mm-hmm. Can I dig it now, or is there something I can do to it in the ground to make it easier to pull next spring?
Well, you could dig it now. This is a traditional time to harvest horseradish and then process it and keep it in the fridge. I'm not sure how well it'll store from now all the way till spring if you just wrapped it up and put it in the refrigerator. It might kind of dry out and not have as much flavor and juiciness to it. So one thing you could probably try is if you have that horseradish patch in an area where you can throw a lot of hay mulch on top of it, like I was talking earlier about the carrots, you can do the same thing with the horseradish. Put a couple foot layer, literally a big pile of hay on top of it, and just leave it there. And then hopefully, even in the Northeast Kingdom, where it gets very cold, and if you can get a nice snow cover on top of that, that'll weigh it all down. And then come Passover next spring, you can kind of dig through there, and hopefully the ground is not so frozen that you can get in and actually pull some fresh horseradish out.
That would be nice.
Fresh horseradish is great.
We have Beth in Jericho who says, I have a first-year planting of Fuggles hops. It survived and grew, but how do I put it to bed in our northern Zone 3 Jericho climate? Help, a single plant cost $15.
Well, hops is a very aggressive plant, luckily, so one plant will quickly turn into many plants over time. But hops is an herbaceous perennial, so you'd want to cut that back at this time of year, back down to the ground, clean it up, and that's really all you'll need to do with it. I'm not familiar with that specific variety, but most of the hops that I know are very hardy and do pretty well in this climate. If it is a kind of hop variety that might be marginal, you can always, again, mulch it over November sometime with some bark mulch, some wood chips, something that will just insulate the roots a little bit, especially the first year.
All right, we have a couple of questions about asparagus. Let's go first to Al in Bennington. Hi, Al. Your thoughts.
Hi there.
Hi. Are you moving your phone around,
he's,
Al?
He's munching on something.
Yeah. Sorry, I was washing dishes.
Oh, there you go.
Got distracted.
Multitasking.
There.
Yes.
Trying.
So go right ahead.
So we've had a... Can you hear me?
Yes, we gotcha.
Okay. We've had an asparagus bed for 25 years or so, and the past few years, the bugs have gotten they're beating us and eating many of the leaves, and I pick them off, but I can't pick them off fast enough. And this past year, some animals started eating the asparagus. So the bed is kind of looking a little tired, and I wonder, is there a lifespan for asparagus beds? And if not, can you suggest what I might do to rejuvenate it?
Sure.
Al, thanks for the call. And I'm going to pair you with Andrew, who says, we got Andrew. I'm going to pair you with Lindsay. Lindsay says, I want to move my asparagus. Is this a bad idea? And when and how should I do it? So just go over all of the asparagus.
All the big asparagus things. So asparagus does have a long lifespan. That's why it's such a favorite vegetable to grow. I've known beds that have been 20, 30, 40 years old. A lot of it depends upon the health of the soil and the maintenance of them. And usually the thing that gets to asparagus even more so than the insects is disease and weed competition. So trying to keep the bed weed free, trying to keep the soil well drained so you don't get a lot of disease buildup in there, that's the thing that will ensure that the asparagus bed continues on for many years. Now, as far as the asparagus beetle, which I think is what he was referring to as far as the insect is eating them, they are a tough insect to control. The thing to watch for is that as your asparagus spears start coming up in the spring, they're going to start hatching and coming out as adults to start feeding. And so if you can try to control them at that point, try to watch for these little hairs sticking out on the actual asparagus spear. Those are the eggs of the asparagus beetle. You can kind of crush those as you're going along. I'm assuming he doesn't have a huge patch, so he'll be able to do that. That will help reduce the population. And then certainly once the fronds come up and the ferns come up and it turns into the asparagus, the mature asparagus, you can spray things to kill those grub-like, those gray slug-like grubs that are eating a lot of the leaves. And there are things from insecticidal soap to neem oil to spinosad that will actually kill them. So I would think just being a little more diligent about controlling those will help. And then putting down some compost. Compost this time of year is a nice thing to put down in the asparagus bed. It'll help rejuvenate it, help bring it back, and, of course, weeding, as I mentioned before.
The thing that always intimidates me, Charlie, is this idea that if wherever I plant my asparagus, I'm going to have to want it to be there for 10, 20, 30, 40 years.
Yeah, it's a commitment, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like getting married.
True.
It is like that. Yes, and if you do want to try to move it, it's not an easy thing to move. If it's a young bed, if it's like you put it in last year and it's like, oh, no, I can't have it there. I've got to move it. You can probably dig up the crowns and move them because they haven't gotten that established yet. But if it's been in there 3, 4, 5 years or so, the crowns are getting pretty well established, and digging them up and moving them to another location is going to set them back almost so much that it's worth actually starting over again. So it's not an easy thing to move. If you do want to do that, I would suggest moving it early spring before the spears start coming up, and don't cut anything for a year or two. So don't harvest anything from that bed.
Okay, so don't touch them right now, Lindsay.
Yeah, don't touch them now, Lindsay.
Got it. We're going over gardening tips with Charlie Nardozzi, horticulturist and gardening consultant. And if you have a question, maybe you're looking at your garden and thinking, boy, I could use some help. All right, Charlie is your guy, and he's here now. So give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Again, that number is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We'll talk more about organic weed control. We'll talk maybe a little bit about what else you should do to put your garden to bed to get it ready for winter when we come back here on Vermont Edition. Hi, welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and I'm talking gardens today and the transition from the growing season to fall with horticulturist Charlie Nardozzi. We're also hearing from some of our VPR colleagues who've been sharing their ideas about what's happening in their garden and what they're thinking about at this time of year. Gail England has this observation: that distinctive fragrance of cool, moist air mixed with falling leaves is everywhere. The end of the growing season is unmistakable. Pretty soon, I'll be out cutting back the perennials, pulling out the last remnants of this year's veggie patch and layering everything with dried leaves on the compost pile. Next year's garden will benefit from this year's leftovers. And Commentary's producer Betty Smith writes about flowers and veggies that she's growing. She says the total effect is colorful, flavorful, and very unruly. The garden is right outside the back door and within view of the kitchen sink. I've watched birds, bees, and dragonflies visit all summer long. Probably not a surprise that most of the public radio staff has a garden.
Has nice gardens,
yeah.
Yes.
So listeners, many of you also have gardens. It seems to be a very, very popular hobby here in Vermont. And if you have a question for Charlie Nardozzi, call 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We have Dan in Underhill who says, thank you, Charlie, for introducing me to straw bale gardening last year. Mm-hmm. I had great success with cucumbers this summer growing in the bales. I'm planning to expand this feature next year, and I'm planning to purchase my straw bales through a bulk order with a neighboring strawberry farmer in the fall. Now, before we get to Dan's question, just for people who are unfamiliar with straw bale gardening, explain what it is, Charlie.
Sure. So straw bale gardening is actually an old technique that's kind of been revitalized by the book Straw Bale Gardening that was published, I think, a year or so ago. And what it is you take straw and you condition it for about 2 weeks. Conditioning meaning you're watering it, you're applying fertilizer, you're basically starting that, accelerating that decomposition process. Then after that couple-week period in the spring, you can literally plant your transplants of tomatoes or marigolds or seed crops right in the bale itself with a little potting soil and compost on top for it to hold the plant in place. And then you just let it grow. And amazingly enough, as that bale starts decomposing, the plant keeps growing and grows really well. And I've been doing it for a couple years now. This year I grew cherry tomato and karela, which is an Indian vining vegetable, on it. And again, it did really well, just like he was saying.
Okay, so Dan says, can I put them in their place this fall so they begin their soaking process all winter under snow? Or is it better to keep the bales in dry storage and start their spring soaking treatment with fresh, dry bales? My thoughts: advantage, they would be thoroughly soaked. Disadvantage, they might take a while to thaw. I would want to put them to use near the end of May.
Yeah, I would keep them dry and then start fresh in the spring. And if you really want to try to get them a jump start on the season, you certainly can put them out a little bit earlier, let them get a couple nice soaking rains in the spring, try to get that process going faster. My fear is that if you put them out in the fall, they're going to actually start decomposing, especially if it stays warm in this fall and then early next spring. And you're going to kind of be you know, as the season progresses next year, the bales are actually going to be kind of falling apart for you. So it's better to start with fresh bales in the spring.
I mentioned organic weed control, and that's a question that Robert in Berlin has. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm growing a perennial. And I've got a lot of problems with annual weeds coming up and sort of smothering the perennial that I'm starting from seed.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard a lot about alternatives to Roundup. And as you know, Roundup is really controversial right now. There's a lot of discussion about limiting it or banning it. And what I've heard is that it's possible to use a 20% acetic acid vinegar and hit the tops of the weeds and burn them back and let the perennial come up from underneath. Charlie, do you know anything about that?
Yes, there are actually some commercial organic herbicides that use 20% acetic acid to do that very thing. Some of them use clove oils. There's a number of different ones out there. And they are pretty effective. They're best sprayed on a sunny day, right on top of the plant. They're a contact herbicide, so they have to be right on whatever leaves you come in contact with the herbicide. They'll die. Other ones, if you don't hit them, they won't. And it is something where it might knock the plant back, but if it's a tenacious annual with a good root system, it'll come right back again. So you might have to be diligent about it. One other thought with annual herbs especially, or annual weeds especially, is that you can use corn gluten herbicide on them. A corn gluten herbicide is something you spread in lawns in the spring to stop the germination of crabgrass seed. It is an all-purpose pre-emergent herbicide, meaning it'll kill any seed as it starts to emerge, and it's organic. It's made from corn, a byproduct of the corn industry. And so if you have a perennial plant that's already in the garden and growing well, growing from its root system, it won't affect that. So in the spring, what you might consider doing is getting some of this corn gluten, spreading it around when you start seeing some of that germination happening, and it will kill those seedlings as they start germinating and hopefully reduce the weed population.
Andrew says, I have Bartlett pears in abundance but not ripened. Should I pick them now or let them hang up there?
Well, don't let them hang too long because any of the pears, you need to pick them when they're still hard. So at this time of year, whatever size they are, whatever maturity they are, they're probably not going to get any more mature. The days are short. The nights are cool. They're just not going to be continuing to grow. So I would go ahead right now, if you have nothing else to do, and pick all your Bartlett pears, bring them inside to a warm room, and they will start ripening inside.
What else do you want to be doing right now in the garden?
So right now in the garden, one thing I've been really leaning more towards with my raised beds especially is as I'm cutting things back of vegetables, and this what I was thinking of, is instead of pulling plants out, instead of pulling out old broccoli, old tomatoes, old peppers, if the plant is not heavily disease infested or insect infested, what I've been doing is been cutting it off at the soil level. So instead of pulling the root system out, I leave the root system in place in the soil. And what I found happens is that as that root system goes through the winter and spring, it slowly breaks down and it's creating these air passageways in my soil so that other plants that I will plant in the spring will actually grow better this way. So I've been really moving more towards that where I'm not turning it under, not tilling it under, not pulling things out. And as you pull soil out, of course, there's a lot of soil, a lot of roots out. You have a lot of soil on the root system itself. So you're taking a lot of that precious compost and that you already added and you're just throwing it in your own compost pile. So why do that? Why not just compost it in place?
Okay, so what if you're somebody like me and you've got a lot of weeds as well as some of those plants? Can I just cut everything off and just
You could just cut everything off. Now the weeds, of course, it would be nice if you had done it, Jane, you know, before they went to seed and they were throwing seeds all over the place. But that being said, yes, you could cut them right down, especially if they're annual weeds like pigweed, lamb's quarters, things of that nature. They're not going to come back from their root system. If they're a perennial weed like a dandelion, a plantain, those you probably want to try to pull out as much as you can.
Okay, got it. All right, let's go to Steve, who's calling in from Fairfax. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I have two questions for you. First off, I'm really enjoying the show. My wife and I both left the garden. First question is, I want to plant some rye as a cover crop. What is the correct variety, and is this a good time? The second question concerns using a tiller or not. As Charlie just addressed, certain non-till methods, are there problems with soil compaction, and so on?
Steve, sure. You should get to know Michelle in Williston because it's remarkable. Her question is, I've never done a cover crop. It seems like I'm just finishing cleaning up the garden in October. And she wants to know, if she plants a cover crop, how does it have time to grow? And then she says, also, I don't till my garden in the spring. I just use a hand tiller to disturb the top few inches. So would a cover crop still work if I don't do a deep tilling? And if I don't do a cover crop, is it okay just to leave the garden bed bare? So both Steve and Michelle with the questions about cover crops.
They should
tilling.
Get together and talk cover crops.
Exactly.
So yes, we're now into October, so probably the only cover crop you can really safely sow to get any kind of germination now would be winter rye. There's no specific variety of winter rye, just whatever you can get. Make sure it's not an annual rye, but the winter rye that's the cereal grain. But the one downside, as Steve and Michelle both allude to, with putting in a cover crop, even though it's great to build organic matter, and especially the rye actually has an alleliopathic effect, so it actually inhibits weed growth too in your soil. But you do have to turn it under in next spring. And if you don't do that, if you just mow it down, it'll continue to grow. It wants to set out the awns, the flower heads that create the rye seed. So you do have to till it under or turn it under some way in the spring. So that's kind of the downside if you're trying to do a no-till method with the cover crops, is that something like winter rye that stays alive through the winter is something that you're going to have to address. The other option, even though it's a little late to do that now, probably would be better if you did it in September, would to be use a cover crop that would actually die through the winter. Oats and field peas are a really nice combination for that because it's a grain and a legume, and they grow up really well in the fall. And then come winter, they just die back. So then in the spring, you don't have to worry about tilling them under. You can just fluff the soil lightly and then plant your transplants in.
I want to squeeze in a note from Alice in Killington who says, I planted some 10 to 12 foot tall river birch trees in June. Some people say they should be planted in the fall and they won't survive because I planted them too early. This makes no sense to me, says Alice. The more time they have to establish, the better, right? Anyway, the trees have established nicely, so what can I do to give them the best chance of making it through the winter?
Yeah, usually in Vermont, because we have such a cold winter, spring planting of trees is better. You can certainly get away with it in the fall, especially deciduous trees. And if you can protect them a little bit, it's okay. But
so Alice did the right thing.
She did the right thing, yeah. And as far as protecting them, you can put some tree guards around them, especially if you have a lot of wildlife around, beavers and things like that, that mice that might come over and girdle those young trees. But other than that, the river birch is a hardy enough tree, it should survive okay.
All right, Charlie, you can leave us with some last pearls of wisdom here for early October, end of the gardening season. What should we be thinking about?
What you should be thinking about? Well, even though Peter is talking about growing greens inside and herbs inside, you can actually bring some of the things from your garden inside. So you can pot up your rosemary, your parsley, your chives, bring them into a sunny window. You'll get to enjoy them right through the holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas. If they don't survive the winter, it's okay. But a lot of these, like the rosemary and the chives especially, can't survive the winter, so you can bring them back outside next year.
And do you do that with all of your herbs?
I do that with some of my herbs. There's only so much room, Jane.
Well, if you want more pearls of wisdom from Charlie Nardozzi, you can, of course, listen to VPR's Vermont Garden Journal, which he hosts. Charlie Nardozzi is also a horticulturist and a gardening consultant, and we have a link to his website up at vpr.net. The Vermont Garden Journal, if you want to hear it, it's on Friday evenings and Sunday mornings. Charlie, have a great autumn. Always nice to talk with you.
Yes, nice to talk to you too, Jane.
And that does it for today's show. Now, how high is the cost of living in Vermont? In a recent Castleton poll, it was cited as one of the top issues concerning Vermonters. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to dive into those numbers to see what factors affect our cost of living and how it compares with other parts of the region and the country. So send your questions or your thoughts to vermontedition@vpr.net and be sure to tune in tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Hannah Kearns. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.